The effect is spoiled only by his usual grab at his garments, the scuffle as he shrugs himself together, and even then he seems to step backwards and tread on his own feet. He thinks of Mary at Hatfield, rising from her stool and forgetting where she'd left it. After some fashion, Moore is bundled out of the room. "Now, he's got exactly what he wants," he says. He puts his palm against the glass of the window. He sees the smudge it makes against the old floored glass. A bank of cloud has come up over the river. The best of the day is behind them. Audley crosses the room to him. Hesitant, he stands at his shoulder. "If only Moore would indicate which part of the oath he finds objectionable. It is possible something might be written to meet his objection." "You can forget that. If he indicates anything, he is done for. Silence is his only hope. And it's not much of a hope at that."
"The king might accept some compromise," Cranmer says.
"But I fear the queen will not. And indeed," he says faintly, "why should she?" Audley puts a hand on his arm.
"My dear Cromwell, who can understand more? His friend Erasmus told him to keep away from government. He told him he had not the stomach for it, and he was right. He should never have accepted the office I now hold. He only did it to spite Wolsey, whom he hated."
Cranmer says,
"He told him to keep away from theology too, unless I am wrong."
"How could you be? Moore publishes all his letters from his friends. Even when they reprove him, he makes a fine show of his humility and so turns it to his profit. He has lived in public. Every thought that passes through his mind he has committed to paper. He never kept anything private till now." Audley reaches past him, opens the window. A torrent of birdsong crests on the edge of the sill and spills into the room, the liquid, fluent notes of the storm thrush. "I suppose he's writing an account of today," he says, "and sending it out of the kingdom to be printed. Depend upon it, in the eyes of Europe we will be the fools and the oppressors, and he will be the poor victim with a better turn of phrase." Audley pats his arm. He wants to console him, but who can begin to do it? He is the inconsolable Master Cromwell, the unknowable, the inconstruable, the probably indefeasible Master Cromwell. Next day, the king sends for him. He supposes it is to berate him for failing to get Moore to take the oath. "Who will accompany me to this fiesta?" he inquires. "Master Sadler?" As soon as he enters the king's presence, Henry gestures with a peremptory sweep of his arm for his attendants to clear a space and leave him alone in it. His face is like thunder. "Cromwell, have I not been a good lord to you?" He begins to talk, gracious and more than gracious, own sad unworthiness, if fallen short in any particular, begs most gracious pardon. He can do this all day. He learned it from Wolsey. Henry says, "Because my Lord Archbishop thinks I have not done well by you. But," he says in the tone of one misunderstood, "I am a prince known for my munificence." The whole thing seems to puzzle him. "You are to be Master Secretary. Rewards shall follow. I do not understand why I have not done this long ago, but tell me. When it was put to you about the Lords Cromwell that once were in England, you said you were nothing to them. Have you thought further?" "To be honest, I never gave it another thought. I wouldn't wear another man's coat or bear his arms. He might rise up from his grave and take issue with me." "My Lord Norfolk says you enjoy being low-born. He says you have devised it so to torment him." Henry takes his arm. "It would seem convenient to me," he says, "that wherever we go, though we shall not go far this summer, considering the Queen's condition, you should have rooms provided for you next to mine, so we can speak whenever I need you, and where it is possible, rooms that communicate directly, so that I need no go-between." He smiles toward the courtiers. They wash back, like a tide. "God strike me," Henry says, "if I meant to neglect you. I know when I have a friend." Outside, Ralph says, "God strike him. What terrible oaths he swears. He hugs his master. This has been too long in coming. But listen, I have something to tell you when we get home.
Tell me now. Is it something good?
A gentleman comes forward and says, Master Secretary, your barge is waiting to take you back to the city.
I should have a house on the river, he says, like Moore.
Oh, but leave Austin Friars. Think of the tennis court, Rafe says, the gardens. The king has made his preparations in secret.
Gardiner's arms have been burned off the paintwork. A flag with his coat of arms is raised beside the Tudor flag. He steps into his barge for the first time, and on the river, Rafe tells his news. The rocking of the boat beneath them is imperceptible. The flags are limp. It is a still morning, misty and dappled, and where the light touches flesh or linen or fresh leaves, there is a sheen like the sheen on an eggshell. The whole world luminous, its angle softened, its scent watery and green.
I have been married half a year, Rafe says, and no one knows, but you know now. I have married Helen Barr.
Oh, blood of Christ, he says. Beneath my own roof. What did you do that for?
Rafe sits mute while he says it all. She's a lovely nobody. A poor woman with no advantage to bring to you. You could have married an heiress. Wait till you tell your father. He will be outraged. He will say I have not looked after your interests.
And suppose one day her husband turns up?
You told her she was free, Rafe says. He is trembling.
Which of us is free?
He remembers what Helen had said. So I could marry again, if anybody wanted me. He remembers how she had looked at him, a long look and full of meaning, only he did not read it. She might as well have turned somersaults. He would not have noticed. His mind had moved elsewhere. That conversation was over for him, and he was on to something else. If I had wanted her for myself and taken her, who could have reproached me for marrying a penniless laundress, even a beggar off the street? People would have said, so that was what Cromwell wanted, a beauty with supple flesh. No wonder he disdained the widows of the city. He doesn't need money. He doesn't need connections. He can afford to follow his appetites. He is Master Secretary now, and what next? He stares down into the water, now brown, now clear as the light catches it, but always moving. The fish in its depths, the weeds, the drowned men with bony hands swimming. On the mud and shingle there are cast-up belt buckles, fragments of glass, small warped coins with the king's faces washed away. Once when he was a boy he found a horseshoe. A horse in the river? It seemed to him a very lucky find. But his father said, if horseshoes were lucky, boy, I would be the king of cocaine. First he goes out to the kitchens to tell Thurston the news.
Well, the cook says easily, as you're doing the job anyway.
A chuckle.
Bishop Gardiner will be burning up inside. His giblets will be sizzling in his own grease.
He whisks a blooded cloth from a tray.
See these quails? You get more meat on a wasp.
Malmsey, he suggests.
Seethe them. What, 3 dozen? Waste of good wine. I'll do some for you, if you like. Come from Lord Lyle at Calais. When you write, tell him, if he sends another batch, we want them fatter or not at all. Will you remember?
I'll make a note, he says gravely. From now on I thought we might have the council meet here sometimes when the king isn't sitting with us. We can give them dinner before.
Right, Thurston titters. Norfolk could do with some flesh on his twiggy little legs.
Thurston, you needn't dirty your hands. You have enough staff. You could put on a gold chain and strut about.
Is that what you'll be doing?
A wet poultry slap. Then Thurston looks up at him, wiping pluck from his fingers.
I think I'd rather keep my end in case things take a downturn. Not that I say they will. Remember the Cardinal, though.
He remembers Norfolk.
Tell him to go north, or I will come where he is and tear him with my teeth.
May I substitute the word bite?
The saying comes to him. Homo homini lupus. Man is wolf to man. So, he says to Rafe after supper, you've made your name, Master Saddler. You'll be held up as a prime example of how to waste your connections. Fathers will point you out to their sons. I couldn't help it, sir. How not help it? Rafe says as dry as he can manage. I am violently in love with her. How does that feel? Is it like being violently angry? I suppose. Maybe. In that you feel more alive. I do not think I could feel any more alive than I am. He wonders if the Cardinal was ever in love. But of course, why did he doubt? The all-consuming passion of Wolsey for Wolsey was hot enough to scorch all England. Tell me, that evening after the Queen was crowned, he shakes his head, turns over some papers on his desk, letters from the Mayor of Hull. I will tell you anything you ask, Rafe says. I cannot imagine how I was not frank with you. But Helen, my wife, she thought it was better to be secret. But now she is carrying a child, I suppose.
So you must declare yourselves.
Rafe blushes. That evening, when I came into Austin Friars looking for her, to take her to Cranmer's wife, and she came down. His eyes move as if he was seeing it. She came down without her cap, and you after her, with your hair sticking up, and you were angry with me for taking her away. Well, yes, Rafe says. His hand creeps up and he flattens his hair with his palm, as if that would help matters now. They were all gone out to the feasts. That was the first time I took her to bed. But it was no blame. By then she had promised herself to me. He thinks, I am glad I have not brought up in my house a young man without feeling, who only studies his advancement. If you are without impulses, you are, to a degree, without joy. Under my protection, impulses are a thing Rafe can afford. Look, Rafe, this is a, well, God knows, a folly, but not a disaster. Tell your father my promotion in the world will ensure yours. Of course he will stamp and roar. It is what fathers are for. He will shout, I rue the day I parted with my boy to the debauched house of Cromwell. But we will bring him around, a little and a little. Till now the boy has been standing. He subsides onto a stool, hands on his head, head flung back. Relief washes through his whole body. Was he so afraid of me? Look, when your father sets eyes on Helen, he'll understand unless he's what? You'd have to be dead and entombed not to notice. Her bold and beautiful body, her mild eyes. We just need to get her out of that canvas apron she goes around in and dress her up as Mistress Saddler. And of course you will want a house of your own. I will help you there. I shall miss the little children. I've grown fond of them. And Mercy, too. We're all fond of them. If you want this new one to be the first child in your house, we can keep them here. It is good of you, but Helen would never part with them. It is understood between us. So, I shall never have any more children at Austin Friars, he thinks. Well, not unless I take time out of the king's business and go wooing. Not unless, when a woman speaks to me, I actually listen. What will reconcile your father, and you can tell him this, is that from now on, when I am not with the king, you will be with him. Master Risley will tease the diplomats and keep the ciphers, for it is sly work which will suit him. And Richard will be here to head the household when I am absent and drive my work forward. And you and I will attend on Henry as sweet as two nursemaids and cater to his whims. He laughs. You are a gentleman born. He may promote you close to his person, to the privy chamber, which would be useful to me. I did not look for this to happen. I did not plan it. Rafe drops his eyes. I know I can never take Helen with me to court. Not as the world is now. And I do not think it will change in our lifetimes. But look, you have made your choice. You must never repent it. Ralph says, passionate. How could I think to keep a secret from you? You see everything, sir.
Ah, only up to a point.
When Ralph has gone, he takes out his evening's work and begins on it, methodical, tapping the papers into place. His bills are passed, but there is always another bill. When you are writing laws, you are testing words to find their utmost power. Like spells, they have to make things happen in the real world, and like spells, they only work if people believe in them. If your law exacts a penalty, you must be able to enforce it. On the rich as well as the poor, the people on the Scottish borders and the Welsh marches, the men of Cornwall as well as the men of Sussex and Kent. He has written this oath, a test of loyalty to Henry, and he means to swear the men of every burg and village, and all women of any consequence, widows with inheritances, landowners. His people will be tramping the wold and heathland, pledging those who have barely heard of Anne Boleyn to uphold the succession of the child in her womb. If a man knows the king is called Henry, swear him. Never mind if he confuses this king with his father, or some Henry who came before. For princes, like other men, fade from the memory of common people. Their features, on those coins he used to sift from the river silt, were no more than a slight irregularity under his fingertips. And even when he had taken the coins home and scrubbed them, he could not say who they might be. Is this, he asked, Prince Caesar? Walter had said, let's see. Then he had flipped the coin away from him in disgust, saying, it's but a tinny farthing from one of those kings who fought the French wars. Get out there and earn, he'd said. Never mind Prince Caesar. Caesar was old when Adam was a lad. He would chant, when Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? Walter would chase him and hit him if he could catch him. There's a bloody rebel song for you. We know what to do with rebels here. They are dug into shallow graves. The Cornish man who came up the country when he was a boy. But there are always more Cornishmen. And beneath Cornwall, beyond and beneath this whole realm of England, beneath the sodden marches of Wales and the rough territory of the Scots border, there is another landscape. There is a buried empire, where he fears his commissioners cannot reach. Who will swear the hobs and boggarts who live in the hedges and in hollow trees, and the wild men who hide in the woods? Who will swear the saints in their niches, and the spirits that cluster at holy wells, rusting like fallen leaves, and the miscarried infants dug into unconsecrated ground? All those unseen dead who hover in winter around forges and village hearths, trying to warm their bare bones. For they too are his countrymen, the generations of the uncounted dead, breathing through the living, stealing their light from them, the bloodless ghosts of lord and knave, nun and whore, the ghosts of priests and friar, who feed on living England and suck the substance from the future. He stares down at the papers on his desk, but his thoughts are far from here. My daughter Anne said, I choose Ralph. He lowers his head into his hands and closes his eyes. Anne Cromwell stands before him, 10 or 11 years old, broad and resolute like a man-at-arms, her small eyes unblinking, sure of her power to make her fate. He rubs his eyes, sifts his papers. What is this? A list? A meticulous clerk's hand, legible but making scant sense. 2 carpets, 1 cut in pieces, 7 sheets, 2 pillows, 1 bolster, 2 platters, 4 dishes, 2 saucers, 1 small basin, weight 12 pounds at 4 pence the pound. My lady prioress has it, paid 4 shillings. He turns the paper over, trying to find its origin. He sees that he is looking at the inventory of Elizabeth Barton's goods, left behind at her nunnery. All this is forfeit to the king, the personal property of a traitor, a piece of plank which serves as a table, 3 pillowcases, 2 candlesticks, a coat valued at 5 shillings. An old mantle has been given in charity to the youngest nun in her convent. Another nun, a Dame Alice, has received a bed cover. He had said to Moore, prophecy didn't make her rich. He makes a memorandum to himself. Dame Elizabeth Barton to have money to fee the hangman. She has 5 days to live. The last person she will see as she climbs the ladder is her executioner, holding out his paw. If she cannot pay her way at the last, she may suffer longer than she needs. She had imagined how long it takes to burn, but not how long it takes to choke at the end of a rope. In England there is no mercy for the poor. You pay for everything, even a broken neck. Thomas More's family has taken the oath. He has seen them himself, and Alice has left him in no doubt that she holds him personally responsible for failing to talk her husband into conformity. Ask him what in the name of God he's about. Ask him, is it clever, does he think it is, to leave his wife without company, his son without advice, his daughters without protection, and all of us at the mercy of a man like Thomas Cromwell? That's you told, Meg had murmured with half a smile. Head bowed, she'd taken his hand between her own. My father has spoken very warmly of you, of how you have been courteous to him, and how you have been vehement, which he accounts no less a favour. He says he believes you understand him, as he understands you. Meg, surely you can look at me. Another face bowed under the weight of a gable hood. Meg twitches her veils about her, as if she were out in a gale and they would provide protection. I can hold the king off for a day or two. I don't believe he wishes to see your father in the tower. Every moment he looks for some sign of surrender, support. And then, no honour would be too high. I doubt the king can offer the sort of honour he cares for, Will Roper says, unfortunately. Come on, Meg, let's go home. We need to get your mother on the river before she starts a brawl. Roper holds out his hand. We know you are not vengeful, sir, though God knows he's never been a friend to your friends. There was a time you were a Bible man yourself. Men may change opinions. I agree entirely. Tell your father-in-law that. It was a sour note to part on. I shall not indulge more, he thinks, or his family, in any illusion that they understand me. How could that be, when my workings are hidden from myself? He makes a note. Richard Cromwell to present himself to the Abbot of Westminster to escort Sir Thomas More prisoner to the Tower. Why do I hesitate? Let's give him one more day. It is the 15th of April, 1534. He calls in a clerk to tidy and file his papers ready for tomorrow, and lingers by the fire, chatting. It is midnight, and the candles are burned down. He takes one and goes upstairs. Christoph, snoring, sprawls across the foot of his wide and lonely bed. Dear God, he thinks, my life is ridiculous. Wake up, he says, but in a whisper. When Christoph does not respond, he lays hands on him and rolls him up and down, as if he were the lid for a pie, till the boy wakes up, expostulating in gutter French. Oh, by the hairy boys of Jesus! He blinks violently. My good master, I did not know it was you. I was dreaming I was a pastry. Forgive me, I am completely drunk. We have been celebrating the conjunction of the beautiful Helen with the fortunate Ralph. He raises a forearm, curls up his fist, makes a gesture of the utmost lewdness. His arm falls limp across his body. His eyelids slide ineluctably towards his cheeks, and with a final hiccup, he subsides into sleep. He hauls the boy to his pallet. Christoph is heavy now, a rotund bulldog pup. He grunts, he mutters, but he does not wake again. He lays aside his clothes and says his prayers. He puts his head on the pillow. 7 sheets, 2 pillows, 1 bolster. He sleeps as soon as the candle is out. But his daughter, Anne, comes to him in a dream. She holds up her left hand, sorrowful, to show him she wears no wedding ring. She twists up her long hair and wraps it around her neck like a noose. Midsummer. Women hurry to the Queen's apartments with clean linen folded over their arms. Their faces are blank and shocked, and they walk so quickly You know not to stop them. Fires are lit within the Queen's apartments to burn what has bled away. If there is anything to bury, the women keep it a secret between themselves. That night, huddled in a window embrasure, the sky lit by stars like daggers, Henry will tell him it is Catherine I blame. I believe she ill-wishes me. The truth is, her womb is diseased. All those years she deceived me. She couldn't carry a son, and she and her doctors knew it. She claims she still loves me, but she is destroying me. She comes in the night with her cold hands and her cold heart, and lies between me and the woman I love. She puts her hand on my member, and her hand smells of the tomb. The lords and ladies give the maids and midwives money to say what sex the child was, but the women give different answers each time. Indeed, what would be worse? For Anne to have conceived another girl, or to have conceived and miscarried a boy. Midsummer. Bonfires are lit all over London, burning through the short nights. Dragons stalk the streets, puffing out smoke and clattering their mechanical wings. Chapter 2. The Map of Christendom, 1534 to 1535.
Do you want Audley's post? Henry asks him. It's yours if you say so.
The summer is over. The Emperor has not come. Pope Clement is dead, and his judgment's with him. The game is to play again, and he has left the door open, just a chink, for the next Bishop of Rome to hold the conversation with England. Personally, he would slam it shut, but these are not personal matters. Now he thinks carefully. Would it suit him to be Chancellor? It would be good to have a post in the legal hierarchy, so why not at the top? I have no wish to disturb Audley. If your Majesty is satisfied with him, I am too. He remembers how the post tied Wolsey to London when the King was elsewhere. The Cardinal was active in the law courts, but we have lawyers enough. Henry says, only tell me what you deem best. Abased like a lover, he cannot think of the best presents. He says, Cranmer bids me listen to Cromwell, and if he needs a post, a tax, an impost, a measure in Parliament or a royal proclamation, give it to him. The post of Master of the Rolls is vacant. It is an ancient judicial office. It commands one of the kingdom's great secretariats. His predecessors will be those men, bishops for the most part, eminent in learning, those who lie down on their tombs with their virtues in Latin engraved beneath. He is never more alive than when he twists the stem of this ripe fruit and snaps it from the tree. You were also right about Cardinal Farnese, Henry says. Now we have a new pope, Bishop of Rome, I should say. I have collected on my bets. You see, he says, smiling, Cranmer is right. Be advised by me. The court is amused to hear how the Romans have celebrated Pope Clement's death. They have broken into his tomb and dragged his naked body through the streets. The master's house in Chancery Lane is the most curious house he has ever entered. It smells of must, mould, and tallow, and behind its crooked façade it meanders back, a warren of little spaces with low doorways. Were our forebears all dwarves, or were they not perfectly certain how to prop up a ceiling? This house was founded 300 years ago by the Henry that was then. He built it as a refuge for Jews who wished to convert. If they took this step, advisable if they wished to be preserved from violence, they would forfeit all their possessions to the crown. This being so, it was just that the crown should house and feed them for their natural lives. Christoph runs ahead of him into the depths of the house. Look! He trails his finger through a vast spider's web. You've broken up her home, you heartless boy. He examines Ariane's crumbling prey, a leg, a wing. Let's be gone before she comes back. Some 50 years after Henry had endowed the house, all Jews were expelled from the realm. Yet the refuge was never quite empty. Even today, two women lived here. I shall call on them, he says. Christoph is tapping the walls and beams. for all the world as if he knew what he was looking for. "Wouldn't you run," he says with relish, "if someone tapped back?"
"Oh, Jesus," Christophe crosses himself. "I expect 100 men have died here, Jews and Christians both."